right. Welcome, everyone, to the Yogic Studies podcast. I'm your host, Seth Powell. This is episode 40. Today, we have the pleasure of being joined by Dr. Kaylee Smith, who is an assistant professor in religious studies at Georgia College and State University in Milledgeville, Georgia. Kaylee, welcome to the podcast. How are we doing today?
I'm doing pretty good, Seth. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And you were just telling me this is a newly appointed position at Georgia College and State University. So congratulations on the position.
Thank you.
Tell me just a little bit about it.
Well, it's a new position whole cloth. It was just funded. It was just funded and by a generous donation from the Jain community. You know, what I'll be teaching, nonviolence and religion in the fall and things of that stripe, a lot of South Asian religious stuff, but no language stuff is associated with this position. So you can imagine how excited I am to get one last shot to teach Vedic Sanskrit before that part of my brain is removed.
Well, maybe it won't be one last shot, but that's very exciting. I'm glad. Glad we can offer that opportunity for you and obviously for our students to have you come and teach Vedic Sanskrit this summer. We're really excited to have you offer that. And we'll get into more specifics about that course and what students can expect a little bit later in this conversation. But first, just to get us started, maybe just tell us a little bit about yourself, give us some background, tell us a little bit about the nature of your work as a scholar of Vedic traditions.
Once upon a time, long, long ago, when I was just a tender undergraduate, I actually started off as a physics major. I wanted to do theoretical physics. And I sort of bounced around because I was really interested, I guess, in how the world worked. And what that meant started changing for me from sort of a materialist standpoint to a linguistic standpoint. What I mean is the way the world works is depends on who's perceiving it, in a sense. And, you know, in physics, you know, I think probably the most famous version of that, the most Vedantic version of that idea of empiricism is Max Planck's. There's no getting behind consciousness. So I started getting into language and things like that. And so I ended up studying linguistics as an undergraduate. And then I did an MA in linguistics and I worked on Vedic stuff. And it was sort of a weird situation where Sanskrit teaching at my alma mater of the University of Georgia was pretty minimal. We did all the grammar in one semester. We read Epic in one semester and then immediately went on to Vedic. Why? That's because my former professor, Jared Klein, was a great linguist of Vedic. So
Where did you do your undergrad?
Jared Klein at the University of Georgia in Athens, Georgia.
Oh, okay. Right there.
Yeah. So, you know, I basically dove deep into Vedic from the get-go and from a linguistic perspective. And for a long time, I thought, gosh, studying language change, especially change within the Vedic texts themselves was so interesting. I thought that's kind of what I wanted to do. And then I realized I didn't really have anything meaningful to say about language change. If you are an aficionado of linguistics, that's great. If you're really mad about something in linguistics, you might actually have something to contribute. I did not have a bone to pick. I thought that linguistics was really interesting, but what I was really interested in wasn't contributing to linguistics. It was better understanding these texts, these people, this time period. And so that's why I ended up going to get my doctorate at Harvard University and working under Michael Witzel, where my, you know, it's ironic because my statement of purpose when I entered said essentially, oh, I really would like to do a project using careful linguistic analysis to discover individual poet style in the Rig Veda and discover essentially some trace of authorship. And by the time I was done with it, by the time I finished my dissertation, I had sort of viciously attacked that position. The idea that there were distinct linguistically identifiable authors in this collection was one I know that I didn't agree with anymore. And a lot of what I wrote about in the fifth chapter of that dissertation was that these figures, these ideas of these ancient seers were clearly very important, not just to people, not just as cultural memories, but they were important in the performance of Vedic ritual, that these beings needed to be present at the ritual. And so instead of looking for historical figures, I shifted to start looking at, I guess I would say, the sense of memory and presence that was being produced by Vedic texts. So when I say produced, I mean in performance. And when I say Vedic texts, I'm using a very loosey-goosey term to refer to all kinds of texts that we associate with the Vedas, since it's really not proper to say any one text is this Veda or that Veda. We use that colloquially. We talk about the Rig Veda. The Rig Veda is not really one text. And I'll get into that in a moment. But essentially, that's what I started getting into. And my book that I've basically finished, but I have to fix all the parts that are wrong, which is always a great stage to be at, looks at ritual impersonation of the god Indra, but also of the seven seers and other figures in Vedic ritual. So that's kind of what's on the horizon right now, a book about impersonation. It's called The Invisible Mask, for what I feel are clever reasons, since it's verbal impersonation. It's a poem that asserts that you're this other being that transforms you. It's an inherently invisible mask.
Wow, fantastic. Well, I mean, there's so much there in what you just said, and a lot of nuggets I want to unpack throughout this conversation. First, I was just thinking, it's amazing that you had Vedic Sanskrit as an undergrad. Not many undergraduate institutions offer something like that. Was that a linguistics department? Was it a religion department? What was that?
It was a linguistics program. We weren't a department yet. And in fact, we never became a department. I think they might have been thinking about upgrading them to an institute, which is like between a department and a program. It has one funded arch professor. But a program essentially gets all of its instructions and all of its professors from other departments. So you might have someone from Comp Lit, someone from Classics. And Jared Klein is based in Classics. Mm-hmm. But he taught all the old Indo-European languages that I took as an undergraduate, classical Armenian, comparative Greek and Latin, Vedic Sanskrit. We even one summer studied Avestan together, which was fun. So, you know, we because I also did an MA at the University of Georgia, we had a close working relationship of that sort. And so you could dive directly into linguistics without. And then, of course, when I got to Harvard, I realized, oh, my gosh, I am not very good at classical Sanskrit. So in some ways, I had the reverse process of education where I had this Vedic skill set and I had to march forward with time and understand how so did usage change, how do semantics shift over time. So,
wow, yeah, that's so different from, I think, most people's experience, where you're starting with classical Sanskrit and that grammar, and then maybe you'd work your way back to Vedic if that's the direction that you choose to pursue.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. So,
although that method rarely produces someone interested in going back to Vedic. So
you mentioned coming to Harvard and working with Professor Michael Witzel. I think, if I'm not mistaken, maybe the first time we met was in one of his seminars.
Yes, I have a pretty good memory of that moment. We were discussing the Ashwamedha, the horse sacrifice.
Yeah,
and the possible sexual activity involved during that ritual, and you know, whether we should read the text with a hermeneutics of suspicion or a hermeneutics of respect. In this case, actually, you know, it doesn't really matter which one you pick, because we have these pretty explicit sutra literature that postdates the Vedas. But, you know, you don't really need to wonder too hard if you have these like pretty explicit sutra materials. Somebody took it very seriously.
Yeah, that seminar with Witzel was sort of a special experience. There was only a few of us. I think by the end of it was really just me in you know, in his office, sort of just hanging out and getting this sort of just sort of like download of materials, basically, from his encyclopedic brain.
Yeah. I mean, and that's how Michael is. He's kind of an empty Google bar. So my first semester and you just have to know exactly what to type in, right? So some people have trouble learning from Michael because they don't understand the right like Boolean search means.
Mm.
I would spend 6 hours every Thursday with him, and we'd start reading something, and then we'd come to some word that we couldn't like quite find what it was. And so we would go down some strange avenue looking through all these texts on botany or like, native flora and fauna of India, trying to figure out what this thing might be. So you could really, you know, it was really a very old school Gurukulam method of learning Vedic philology.
Yeah, I felt that very much. For our listeners, tell us just a little bit about Witzel and his what he's well known for and his contributions to Indology.
Well, Witzel's very famous. You don't have to Google too much to find the controversies that surround him. I would say personality-wise, he's really like a German George Carlin. He's very snarky, but he's very funny.
Yes.
I remember he got a death threat from somebody who called him an animal. He was like, "You are no more than an animal." And he said, "Yes, thank you. This is a good point. We are all animals." Like he would just, everything would just right off. Yeah. Nothing fazed him.
Yeah.
And
why is he getting death threats? Why are people calling him animals?
Oh. Well, so Witzel, as well as many other scholars, was involved in the California textbook case from the early 2000s, where a group of Americans who were Hindu in California objected to some of the representation of Hinduism in textbooks. Mm-hmm. And I think some of those objections were quite valid and others mm-hmm. were less valid. I could go into the details. I don't want to get too political, but like I'll give you an example of one that I thought was a valid objection was the emphasis these textbooks had on the Varna system, that is the caste system, as being central to Hinduism, which is, uh-huh. I mean, I don't think anybody would say that that is the case for everyone that identifies as a Hindu. In fact, there's a strong caste critique in Hinduism too. So, I mean, these certain things were emphasized to exoticize the Hindu experience. And I think that many people who were upset were rightly upset. There were other things, however, that were less defensible. For instance, they objected to the claim the textbook made that the Mahabharata was composed before the Ramayana, because the events in the Ramayana are set before the events in the Mahabharata. Therefore, if these are historical, then one should come before the other.
Mm-hmm.
But if they're literary creations, perhaps inspired by history, perhaps not, mm-hmm. then we can't really date them based off of when they're set. Just to be a little flippant, I mean, I could write a story about, young Jesus, for instance, and then say right. like, and in fact, many, many young Jesus stories, the infant gospel of Jesus, these sorts of things do exist, but they're considered non-canonical. Well, mm-hmm. I could do that and say, look, this is about when Jesus was 5 and he had a skateboard. Mm-hmm. Therefore, this predates properly the gospels themselves. So, I mean, I understand that could be interpreted as flippantly. My point is it was a complicated debate. Witzel was one of the experts who was, among others, who was called on. And I think that got his attention. That made the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it made him a target.
And then also there were several, he's also strongly associated with Aryan invasion theory. Or Aryan migration theory, the idea that Sanskrit speakers were once upon a time Proto-Indo-Europeans who entered the continent of India, mm-hmm. As opposed to the notion that Indo-European speakers originated in India and migrated mm-hmm. out from there. So he's mm-hmm. he was a strong proponent of Aryan migration theory. And what made him sort of famous in that regard is that somebody said one of the objections was like, look, the Indus Valley civilization does not know what the traditional horse is. There's no images of it. And then, of course, magically, suddenly they found a new Indus Valley seal that looked like a horse. And they said, aha, they do know what horses are. Therefore, Rig Veda, Indus Valley civilization, is one civilization.
Mm.
And Michael said something to the effect of, this is actually the rhino seal with the horn photoshopped off.
Mm.
And then, And true to his sort of funny nature, he called that article Harappan Horseplay. So he also, with Steve Farmer, produced an analysis of the Indus Valley seals that argued that it was not actually a lost alphabet or some sort of language at all, but was some sort of, the equivalent of iconography, like one might see in a board game or on signs or something like that, that they certainly meant something to the people, but they didn't represent syllables or any particular one language. So if you want the Indus Valley civilization to be a Sanskrit-speaking civilization, that's a big problem for you. So that I think sort of drew attention to him,
Didn't
negative
for
attention.
many years Farmer and Witzel, they had like a running bounty, like
Yes.
something like $5,000 or $10,000, if you could definitively prove
Yeah.
them to be wrong,
Yeah.
that in fact the Indus Valley seals do express some sort of language,
Yeah.
that they would reward you with this bounty.
Yeah.
I would always tell my students
Those are the
that.
kinds of theatrics that I think I love Michael, but I think on some level he thrives on. He's not afraid of drama. Whereas I'm very spineless, and I'm always trying to find some sort of middle ground. So not spiny like Michael. I generally think that it's just not productive. I can tell you why I believe in some sort of migration into India theory, and it's not complicated at all. Can I share my screen? This will take 5 seconds.
Let's go for it. I
Yeah.
wasn't planning to take us in this direction, but we're here. Let's
Well, I just want to, because when there's new evidence, I change my mind. But this is the current evidence that I think is very persuasive and hard to easily rebuke. So it's kind of like my current like nugget where I'm like, find a more compelling theory
And
of
just to
this.
be clear, the reason why this question of origins is very significant and is highly controversial and politicized today is because we're talking about whether these Sanskritic traditions originated in the land that is indigenous to the Indian subcontinent, or whether they were brought from outside by Sanskrit-speaking peoples that then migrated in.
And I mean, the truth is, it's not so black and white. The Sanskritic tradition, of course, originated in India as far back as we can measure. The question is, did the speakers who were the ancestors of the Sanskritic tradition, were they biologically Indian or were they biologically migrants? And why is that important? It's only important if you plan on demonizing migrants, right? It's hard to be xenophobic if it turns out you're, well, I would say it's hard to be xenophobic if it turns out you're a nation of immigrants. But on the other hand, I mean, that's what's at stake, right? If you want to, how far back can you extend your nationalism if you are trying to say some people belong here and some people don't? Well, but it's a silly question anyway, because
So
all the great.
you should be able to share your screen now if
All
you
the
want.
great, all many of the great literary achievements of Sanskrit, of course, happened in India itself. But how does that connect to people today? Who are they reading them? If they are, then we can talk about them. Okay, so here's the simple thing that I think is a pretty persuasive argument for why Indo-European, at least, is unlikely to have derived from Sanskrit, right? This is the strongest case of the theory. Sanskrit is the origin language of other Indo-European languages like English, Greek, Latin, etc. Well, Sanskrit has this nice third person. Will I be able to? Darn. There we go. Third person singular, perfect. Didarsha, from the root drish, to see, and this means essentially like he or she has seen. It also, by the way, means I have seen, because there's a first person singular perfect that looks exactly like the darsha for reasons that we'll explore in Vedic. This is actually one of the differences in Vedic grammar, is sometimes first and third singular perfects are different. So that's your Sanskrit form. All right. In Greek, you've got didorke, And actually, let me use the first singular. I'm going to use the first singular I have seen. And the reason I want to use the first singular I have seen is because in Greek, the first singular is dedorka.
Okay.
Okay. So similarly, first singular perfect, I have seen, idem. Now, here's the trick. If Greek is derived from Sanskrit, you have a problem. Because how does this know to become an eh? But this know how to become an O. And then this knows how to stay an right? Sounds aren't sentient. Well, some people would disagree, but at least in terms of modern linguistics, we don't ascribe agency to the word once it's out of your mouth. How does this happen? In fact, it doesn't. It's never observed in natural language, because what that would be called is an unconditioned split. So for a sound to become eh or o or ah, that can happen, but it happens in specific environments conditioned by its particular conditions. For example, if you take Spanish, what would have been an underlying form dedos, the way it's pronounced in Spanish is dedos as a fricative, dedos, and I don't have the IPA character ready, so I'm just going to use a capital D. Dedos, right? But why do you pronounce it the instead of the there? Because it's between vowels. That's intervocalic position. On the other hand, this de stays a de because it's at the beginning of a word. So that would be a case of a condition split. Different conditions change the sound in different ways. This, however, would be an unconditioned split if Greek dedorka was derived directly from Sanskrit. Mm-hmm. But notice there's another twist here, because you can't derive Sanskrit Well, actually, you could in principle derive Sanskrit didarsha from Greek didorka, but there's other reasons you don't want to do that. The simple point is an unconditioned split never happens in human language that we've seen. And the reason is really the second law of thermodynamics. That is, information can't come out of nowhere. You can get information, but you need to do work on it. Sound change, as it goes from phase to phase in an unconditioned manner, reduces information. It cannot create information. So the dorka can lose distinctiveness between e, o, and a by becoming a, but it can't create distinctiveness out of nowhere, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You could create distinctiveness, but that's another process called analogy. So when I have a word brother in English and the plural is brethren, and then suddenly brethren doesn't really look like a good plural for brother, I can invent a new form, brothers, by extending another plural, fruits to brother to make a new brothers. And then I'll keep brethren as some specialized form. But the point there is those kinds of changes are a whole other realm of linguistic change called analogy. This sound change, you don't see unconditioned split because language is an entropic system. And it tends towards entropy until speakers do work on it through analogy. That's why we have Sanskrit words like trida, heart, but then this becomes hardha in a Middle Indic dialect. And by the time you get to like an apabhramsha, you've got something like ha'a with just a pause. Or what that sounds fine, but what if you had a word like mriga? And you had a word like mrita. So one is, this is deer, and then this is going to be dead. Well, if that same sound change happens, you'd get something like ma'a as the output here. This, of course, would pass through a phase of maga, but then it would also be ma'a. So the same sound changes of losing r and then the loss of a consonant between vowels, which are regular sound change happening on the way to Middle Indic and apabhramsha, would force these two words to fall together and become indistinct. That's the kind of erosive effect of sound change over time. But it gets repaired through analogy when we just use new words or use compound words to specify things like that. So anyway, that was a long-winded way of looking at these two words that are the same. But it strongly suggests that Greek and Sanskrit have a common origin, but Sanskrit cannot be the origin of Greeks insofar as we understand the way the second law of thermodynamics applies to language. And if someone can give me a better explanation of that, then I would reconsider migration theory, but no one has yet.
So just to clarify there, you're not saying that there's no relationship between the two. There clearly is, but that based on this example and many others, Sanskrit cannot be argued as the origins point for languages like Greek, but rather both as Indo-European languages, there is likely to be some common source. Is that what is considered Proto-Indo-European, or is that something
else? That's right.
Else?
So, interestingly enough, although the origin of Proto-Indo-European is, of course, a whole other hotly debated topic. With I would say the majority of people putting it, north of the Black and the Caspian Seas, a second large group wanting it to be located in Anatolia and modern day Turkey. Interestingly enough, and this is sort of telling, the Indian academic nationalist camp doesn't really care that much about Indo-Europeans' origins. The idea that Indo-European began in India would be an argument that would be a much easier argument to make, linguistically speaking, than Indo-European languages are derived from Sanskrit.
Right.
If you were to say, hey, Indo-European was what they spoke in Harappa, then a bunch of people migrated out and became whatever language. And then some people who stayed in Harappa after many thousands of years developed the language of Sanskrit. That's a much more defensible premise. But that's not really the argument that people are interested in. The argument has to be that Sanskrit
is the mother of all languages, right?
It can't be a sister. It has to be a mother.
Fascinating. Well, again, this was wasn't planning to go in this direction, but I'm glad we did, because it's great to get your clear, sober kind of overview of that. And I appreciate what you're saying. Is like, look, this is the available evidence as I can see it. And if new evidence comes to light, then we should adapt and change.
Now I don't have to talk about it during the course, which is great. Clear the air.
There you go. Okay. Well, let's get back to once there is a Sanskrit tradition, and let's talk a little bit about the Vedas. What are the Vedas, Kaylee?
Oh boy. Well, as you might have seen in a dictionary, Veda means knowledge, and so that's what's so interesting when we talk about a Rig Veda or an Atharva Veda or a Sama Veda. We often think we're referring to a specific text. But that's not quite exactly right. Veda is like an idea of a text. It's like a bag of textuality into which a certain kind of text will go. So when we colloquially refer to the Rig Veda, 99% of the time we're really talking about the Shakalia Samhita, which is the 1,028 hymns associated with the Rig Veda, all together in Sandhi. We might be talking about the Shakalia Padapata, which is that same text out of Sandhi. Now, why in the world would they have both? Well, because these texts, and this might help us understand why Veda sort of refers to a domain of textual type rather than specific text. This is all in the realm of orally produced texts that were memorized and transmitted from body to body, from master to student for a long, long time. I think I would estimate 3,000 years, but some people want to push that date out. So other people want to pull that date in. I think it's important to show a good humble skepticism with too much date modification. There's good reasons to sort of I think there are good reasons for dating the Vedas as quite old. There are also some reasons that aren't so good. Nevertheless, when we talk about the Vedas, we're talking about a canonical group of texts that today many people take as authorless, eternal, and emanating from the very first syllable at the beginning of the universe, the syllable Om. In fact, that hasn't always been the opinion. That was an opinion that emerged in certain Mimamsa circles in the early classical period, and it was disagreed with by other Sanskrit language schools of philosophy like Nyaya, who are like, no, just some guys did it. And of course, by what are called heterodox groups like Buddhists. So these are sort of big oceans of texts. We could think of them that way, but of oral texts. They are canons of text because of their subdivision. Essentially, the idea of the Vedas, in a very, let's say, sociological sense, started when different kinds of ritual labor were assigned to different groups of people exclusively. So if you're a Rig Vedan, you're going to be reciting poems from the Shakalya Samhita. You will also learn, after you've mastered your Samhita, if we're talking about the Vedic period or the late Vedic period, you'll also learn certain extra texts, like a Brahmana, for instance, the Aitareya Brahmana, which is a commentary. It was not the performative utterances, those are the Samhitas, that you actually did to do the rituals, but they sort of justified this or that ritual action during that, during ritual performance. So the, in broad strokes, when we think of the four Vedas, we are thinking about the oldest text being essentially song books used in the performance of certain rituals. What those rituals did, we can talk about later, and ancillary texts that comment on them. And those are the sum total of what's in the Vedas, in essence. There are also Vedangas. These things do proper pronunciation. They are focused on proper mathematics of the ritual ground, etc. But properly speaking, already at least in the second century BCE, there was a division between what was considered the Vedas, that is, what's Shruti, what's revealed, and what had human authors.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about, on that note, you know, how do we think, what comes to mind for you when we say Vedic texts, when we think of this corpus as sacred text or scripture? Are they poems? Are they hymns? Is it literature? Is it ritual? Liturgy? What are some of the strengths and weaknesses of trying to categorize this body of material that, as you said, was originally oral and then only later composed and written down?
In some ways, it's all that and more. And I think we should all be very hesitant to assign kind of a genre to a Vedic text. And the reason is, for this reason, the Vedic peoples didn't have the relationship I have to a book where I can like read it, throw it down, pick it up later, right? Mm-hmm. It's this external, you know, they would see us in a way as cyborgs, right? We're able to take a piece of the mind and put it in paper. You know, that's it's a stretch of a image, but, you know, that kind of relationship we have to textuality, to writing, to documents, is a relationship of a living person who has total ownership and command of a dead thing.
Well, let alone today with the digitization, now I'm thinking of mind in...
But what
computer.
If you could only ever learn something, or you could only ever find out something from a living person? And I don't mean like, oh, I discovered this land. The land is... I mean, the Vedas were always taught from a living person to a living person. There's a relationship. When you hear a recitation and you want to learn that recitation, you're going to imitate the voice of who recited it to you. And that person, when they were young, was imitating the voice of the person that recited it to them. So there's a long tradition of mimesis, of embodiment of texts. And what makes this, in a sense, special is it disrupts that kind of the possibility that a text could be a dead thing. We have to honor the possibility that texts bear something more than just information. They bear this kind of animacy. They bear the energy of everyone who's put their life into memorizing and you know, vocalizing. And so when I say it's all that and more, I mean, we could transform the Vedas into the dead texts of written on a page. And we will do that to read it because that's how we do it. That's the only real solution, I think, to looking at the language of the Vedas in this day and age where we're not trained. We can't spend 20 years listening. I mean, I guess I could. But what I mean is that these texts were also not just passed down for their own sake, right? They were used. They were used in ceremonies. So if you were to say, hey, is the Vedas poetry? Is it a ritual handbook? Is it a philosophical speculation? What is it? I would say something to you like, well, what's Memorial Day, right? If you go to a Memorial Day event, you're going to see lots of solemn words that are not poems. There's probably going to be someone who sings a song. There's probably going to be some speechification. There's going to be the communal sharing of food. It's a whole event that really defies one genre. And that's exactly what the Vedas were used for. There was a time and place when the Vedic peoples, in a sense, were free peoples. They were freer than we could ever imagine. And I mean in that sense that they had a vastly different relationship to the relationship we have to the idea of law. They lived a very seasonal existence. The rules that governed how they lived, the behaviors they had, shifted with time. It shifted with political relationships. And the Vedas were used in public ceremonies that allowed them to, as a group, reimagine and redefine those political relationships. But they didn't have an eternal thing like the idea of a government. They didn't have, I mean, in a sense, the Vedas are kind of like a constitution. But the point I'm trying to get at is that the Vedas are eventive. They're an active truth in that they are acted upon. And a group of people use the Vedas to think about their own past, their own antiquity, in order to find out what kind of relationships they should have going forward, even if going forward is just for a season or a year. That's the power of the Vedas as a social tool for mediation between Vish or clans. That's what the Vedas were created for. That's what they do. When political relations changed at the end, what we think of as at the end of the Vedic period is the rise of urban culture again in the Gangetic plane. What rises with that urban culture are also inherited monarchies, something which was very foreign to the Vedas. I mean, you see a little bit of that already in the Mahabharata, which is like a love letter to the Vedic period in a sense, where they say, oh, you know, way back in the day, a king would simply pick whoever was the best to be his successor. They didn't just, his baby child wouldn't inherit the kingdom, because what kind of baby child would be fit to be crown prince? So there's already this kind of wistful memory of another way of creating political relations and political linearity and genealogy. The Vedas are very much in that pre-inherited monarchical world. And when they collide with that monarchical world, their use and relationship changes. And in many ways, I think that's still something we don't really understand. I mean, we don't understand it. We don't understand the period when these were sort of documents of government, and the period when the way that small polities and ultimately Mahajanapadas worked no longer depended on the Vedas to renew that social compact. Instead, they had a very different idea of sovereignty. What role did the Vedas take after that seems to have changed a great deal. And that's something that I'm very interested in my research. I still don't know if we've really asked the right questions of that history.
For most Hindus today, the Vedas are taken as primary scriptures for their tradition, for their faith. The Vedas are seen as divinely revealed or inspired by the rishis or seers, and that the knowledge and the contents of the Vedas are seen as eternal and again divinely revealed. How are we to understand that? How do you understand that as a scholar of this corpus, of these traditions? And what can we say about authorship? And what does that mean for a text to be seen or revealed by a rishi? Who were these rishis? Why are they important, you know, to this grouping of texts? What thoughts can you share with us about authorship? I know, as you mentioned, this is a question that you've pursued quite a bit.
I mean, in a sense, there's three answers. Answer one is thinking of the Vedas as timeless and eternal makes perfect sense to me. Because if you grew up in a Vedic family, from the minute you were born, you would hear the constant rolling thunder of recitation of the syllables of the Vedas. You would be born into them, and you would die hearing that in the background, that chanting all the time. From your perspective, in terms of your consciousness, it's an eternal thing. And all the way back to the Jaimini Sutras, Frank Clooney's written about this, in 2nd century BCE is when we generally date them. Already, the idea of the rishis are not as poet creators, but rather no different than the people, the Vedic peoples who are transmitting the Vedas to this day. They were just the first ones to receive and transmit it. But we also have lots of contemporary accounts that disagree with that understanding of the Vedas. So how in the world do we get from timeless and eternal Vedas to this idea that there was a Vedic period and we have older Vedic texts and less old Vedic texts and then the youngest Vedic? And that all comes from the late 19th century. Orientalists had recently, linguists had recently discovered the exceptionlessness of sound law. That is, as I talked about, you know, when a sound law earlier, when a sound law sweeps through a language, it does so with rare exception, exceptionlessly. That is, once upon a time, English had a trilled R, and we'd say things like farmer. Then all those R's, no matter what their position in the language, change to the R we have today, except in places like Scotland, where the trilled R remains because it was outside of that area where all the R's shifted. That's what I mean when I say exceptionlessness of sound law. So by looking at the way that sound law changed in a subconscious way, not something that people do on purpose, late 19th century scholars were able to date the Vedas. They also looked at other features like grammar. Yes, the Vedas are artificially archaizing. What I mean by that is, just like any poetry, it looks back on its predecessors and often imitates. So a poet might imitate an older poet, and that's going to make his or her language seem older just by that act of imitation. I would say all language is a little like that. But so there's the two camps. You've got timeless and eternal Vedas, Vedic period with a slow accretion of text. I would say there's a third way forward, which is, let's just see what the Vedas have to say. And what you'll find is the Vedas, these texts have lots of origins for themselves. That's what's so great. So evidently, on some level, they were able to do what a lot of people can't do anymore, which is accept the possibility of multiple origins, of multiple stories, of multiple ways. So we're going to look in this course at like three or four origin stories for the Vedas, starting with the most traditional one, which is from the Jaimini Upanishad Brahmana, where the Vedas come from the syllable Om. But we're going to see some other possibilities of where these things come from in the texts themselves. Now, the texts themselves likely come from different dates, but in a sense, it doesn't matter, because if the Vedas were timeless and eternal, then we can say they timelessly and eternally accepted the possibilities of multiple narratives about themselves. And that's really interesting. It's, you know, I feel like today people really love canons. They get really mad when perhaps like a certain intellectual property is produced in a show and they don't feel like it matches up to their idea of what that canon character is. Maybe they're mad about She-Hulk, or maybe they're mad about, I don't know, whatever. It doesn't matter. We have this notion of like fandom ownership and canonicity that comes from this long, weird history that goes all the way back to Martian, the guy who first came up with the idea for the New Testament as a canon. And by the way, that guy was like, most of these Paul letters are fake, and only the Gospel of Luke is real, right? Mm-hmm. So he was the first guy to say like, only this stuff, everything else, no. And we're at the other end of that history with only my version of She-Hulk can be She-Hulk. Well, in the Vedas, the Vedas did not have the same form of toxic fandom, evidently, that we see today. So the possibility of multiple stories about them is very much accepted. And I would hope that as we read the text together, we'll open ourselves to multiple possibilities. I think that's the scholarly way too, personally.
That's interesting that you say that about the kind of flexibility of canon within the Vedas. And yet at some point there were lines that were drawn. There is sort of certain institutionalizations and orthodoxies, if you will, that did draw lines of tradition. I'm wondering,
but I mean, here's the thing is, sorry, those texts, they keep making texts.
Right.
And people keep arrogating to themselves, by which I mean claiming that this is Vedic stuff.
I'm thinking of Upanishads in particular. I mean, those throughout the centuries never stopped. Yeah.
And you know,
But I imagine
texts
some
like the
scholars.
Mahabharata, the Bhagavata Purana, they say things like this is really the fifth Veda, right? So it's a space for sacred text that always appears to be closed, but is always a little bit open.
But would like Nambudiri Brahmins in Kerala, would they accept those later texts? I mean, it wouldn't be a part of their tradition, right?
No. Because what they would accept for the purposes of recitation is what they learned as children. So in that sense, it can be very, very, I mean, it is very conservative, especially Nambudiri Brahmins, because they're the last Vedans that are 100% off book, right? I
That's
mean, they need nothing.
amazing. Did you had a chance to go to India with Vitsal and a group from Harvard, right? For a
That's right.
recreation of an, was it an Agni Chayana
It was.
ceremony?
Oh, it was even better. It was an Atiratra, which is like an Agni Chayana on Nodos and Jolt Cola. An Atiratra is a it's the 12-day version of the Agni Chayana. Same big firebird altar, but at the end it's got this 1,000 verse overnight recitation. It goes to the dawn into the Ashvins, and it's very impressive and very long. And
Was
a lot of
Finian Garrity there
yeah,
with you
Finn
guys
was
as well?
there. I remember him interviewing at the very end of the ritual. You know, there were some people upset because halfway through the 12 days there had been some light rain, and people were really expecting rain only at the end of the ritual, right? This was the delivery. So like, even though rain is something you want, the fact that it came too early, there was tea shop talk that something was wrong with these priests. They were eating fish on the sly or something like that. But Finn, I remember, interviewed the Udgathar, the head Samaveden, at the very end of the ritual. At the very end of the ritual, you know, suddenly the sky cracked in the final moments when they're about to set everything on fire, because at the end of this particular ritual, you burn everything down. And then these, you know, arrows of cold rain shot through the sky and just flooded everything. And, you know, so people got what they wanted. We were all running around in the rain and in the fire, and people were running up to me asking me if I felt the yaga effect. And of course, I did feel it. I mean, everyone felt it there. It was dangerous. There had been some scientists there who wanted to study the properties of sacred fire, who didn't go to that last day because they feared it was too dangerous. It was a swirling vortex of people feeling the yaga effect. And Finn asked the Udgathar how he felt, and he said, "I feel powerful." So you know, one of those had to be their moments. But after all this time and dedication to very precise things, to have such a dramatic finale, you know, you'd be hard pressed to feel nothing.
Just say a few words. What's so significant about this Atiratra ceremony and it being done today in or I don't know when that was, a few years
Well, in
back, but
principle, it hadn't been done since 1975.
and that was
Different Vedic.
that was when Fritz Stahl and his crew
That's
went out
right.
and created that
That's right.
doc
And that's something
film
your
Altar
students
of
can
Fire.
watch if they haven't already. It's on YouTube. It's a 45-minute documentary.
And
It
prior to
helps
that,
preserve
though, it
facts.
hadn't been done for quite a while, right?
Yeah. Well, and specifically, it hadn't been done there in Panyal, in Kerala. Now, if you walk through Panyal, you'll see the old sites of ancient fire altars. The most dramatic one has a tree growing through the middle of it because it's from like 1901. It's a very old Atiratra. And in the Nambudiris are the most archaic Vedic tradition that still exists because they're completely off book, but they only really do two big Shrauta rituals. The two big rituals they do is they do the Agni Stoma and then the Agni Chayana Atiratra, that is the Atiratra form of the Agni Chayana. So it's those two things. And you can't do the second one until you've done the first one. So there are a lot of, and you can't do the first one until you're at Ahetagni. So, I mean, there are a lot of preconditions to doing one of these big things. It's also extremely expensive because it takes so long. You have to have all this food prepared. It will draw onlookers. Onlookers need to be fed. And, it becomes an event of thousands of people. And, that was another thing people were curious about. Where did all the money come from? And it seemed to come from a trust that was based in Qatar. And so many people speculated about what that meant. I never got any real answers because people love to speculate. But you know, it's a rare event. Now, probably it happens more than we'd think, but I don't think it had. At least it had been on the down low until 2011. And then when 2011 happened, people realized there was a significant amount of tourism possible for this, right?
Sure.
Because most of the many people were not, I mean, Panyal is not a big village. So a lot of people were drawn there, were probably, I mean, tourists from all over India that wanted to see this, what was called a 3,000-year-old Vedic rite. I mean, I would probably call it a 2,500-year-old Vedic rite personally.
But still, but we're talking about one of the
pretty
most
old, pretty
ancient
old.
Human yeah. rites that's, right. you know, maybe there's some adaptations, you know, obviously a few changes and things, but by and large, they're doing the same thing that they would have done over 2,000 years ago.
That's right. Something that was, you know, that was already, you know, 1,500 years old when some guy was coming up with Beowulf, right? I mean, like...
Yeah. That's incredible.
Old stuff. Old
and
stuff.
Finn produced that short film, Mantras to the Max, which, and so that footage must have been from that event. Is that right?
I mean, it could be, but Finn has gone back.
Yeah.
And has a good close relationship with the Nambudiri community. Whereas I'm more of a dusty textbook scholar. You know, I think I'm not really great just to talking to people I know and in my own family. So let alone being like a savvy anthropologist who, you know, whatever.
Come on.
Everyone has different strengths and
you can talk to just about anybody about anything is my experience with you. But hey,
really?
let's shift gears. I'm sure a lot of people listening who are thinking about this course are thinking about, they want to hear a little bit about Vedic Sanskrit. So tell us a little bit, you know, we'll get into what you're going to teach in the course, but just to get us going there, you know, as we said, most people are probably more familiar with classical Sanskrit and then kind of moving back. So especially for folks who maybe have studied a little bit of Paninian classical Sanskrit, just what are, in your mind, some of the key differences between classical Sanskrit and Vedic Sanskrit?
Probably the most striking one is something that in the Greek tradition they call timesis, although it's not really properly timesis, because timesis means cutting. The idea that you can cut a preverb off of a verb. It's more likely the case that the preverb was never attached in any firm or fixed manner in our Vedic texts. That is, very often a Vedic sentence or verse will begin with the preverb and end with the verb. I don't know, I should reverse this. Begin with a preverb and end with a verb. And then what is syntactically construed with the verb is interior to that construction. So you might have pra, dot, 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 the rest of the sentence. And at the end, some nice, beautiful aorist like got. and you get to construe that because I guess the closest thing is, imagine if you as an English speaker had heard words like don't upset her. But then you'd never heard anyone say, don't set me up. And then you thought, don't set me up. Is that the same thing as upset? Or is it something different? Is to set someone up different than to up someone set? Right. So in the Vedas, because of the fluidity of the preverb, we're left often wondering, is the sense a very, is it a very physical sense to up? Set someone? Is it a metaphorical sense? Or is it something that is derived on some second order metaphor, right? So, you know, what are the idiomatic senses of these verbs? Sometimes a verb clearly has already fused with its preverb, and then you might get another preverb that's detached from it. So there's lots of stuff like that. The verb is extremely expressive in Sanskrit in the ways that classical Sanskrit is very expressive, but it does so often by means other than the verb. So, for instance, all the aspects have real concrete meanings in Rig Vedic poetry. They're not just stems you learn. Panini will tell you, oh, the aorist is when something happened earlier that day. The imperfect is when something happened earlier, but it was before today. And the perfect is something that happened beyond your own memory, right? Well, That's not entirely so. In fact, it's very different in Vedic. It seems like in Vedic, it's almost wrong to think of the verb as having really a distinct tense. Rather, what aspect is the present stem, and it's imperfect, is the default. Shut up, cat. Is the default aspect. It's not specified for terms of how the action is carried out. But the aorist certainly implies an action that is immediate. I'm going to let this cat out.
Oh, I can't hear it at all.
Oh, you can't hear the cat. Okay.
No, well, no, not at all. Not at all. So no problem here. Cats are always welcome at yogic studies too, by the way.
The aorist is a verb that reflects an action that has already been completed in the sense that it started and completed. The difference between, like, you know, if I said the cheese melts, I'm not saying that the cheese is in a process of melting, right? It's now, once the melting happens, it's done. Mm. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So similarly, perfects are kind of a fusion of the present and that aorist. They are a result that is the culmination of a process. So we know the root gum is like to go, right? Mm. But if I said jagama in Vedic, this would not mean I went. It would mean I have arrived, because the culmination, the result of a process of going, has concluded with my finishing that going. That is my arrival. Mm. So if I said ah jagama, that's just I am arrived. It's not a past tense. If I wanted it to be I had arrived, I would need to make a past tense to that perfect. That's a pluperfect. That's something that Vedas do.
Mm.
So it's just a much bigger verbal system with a lot more options in it. And the verb is very important.
What about one of the things you hear most commonly that Vedic has that classical dropped or no longer carried forth is accent, or sometimes referred to as tone or pitch. Tell us a little bit about that. And you see that represented both in the Devanagari, you know, once this was committed to writing, with those sort of diacritic marks above the characters, as well as in transliteration.
Yeah, the accent is important, because sometimes it's the only way to solve some of the grammar. So it's not just that different words sounded different. They often have grammatical consequences. So for instance, I'm going to share my screen and give you just a quick example.
Sure, great.
Need to turn this in. All right, so these are two different words in Vedic because the accent is different. This is the neuter noun, yeshus, and it really means something like worth. Sometimes that's translated as fame, but I think that's actually a little off. I think it means worth. Whereas this is an adjective that means worthy. So whereas yeshus is always going to be a neuter noun, yeshus is going to modify some guy. So if I said, oh, look at this guy, that's not the symbol I want. You know what? I don't actually have a diacritic at the ready right now for long A. So I'm going to use capital A. I'm going to use capital H for my Visarga. If you said this guy's Yeshaha, that would be the nominative singular adjective, masculine adjective for someone who is worthy. Okay? You would never see this form in any of the iterations of a neuter noun worth. And you would know this because of the accent. Similarly, Brahman is a neuter noun, man stem. So you get Brahma in the nominative accusative singular, but Brahman is the masculine noun. This is a speech act, a poetic composition. The Brahman might be the Rig Vedic poem. The Brahman is the person who formulated that. And so sometimes it's translated as composer or formulator, sometimes just as priest. Mm. Although really, to do it justice, I would almost call him a hierophant. That is a revealer of the Brahman, since very often what the texts say is not that he creates a Brahman creates a Brahman, but they often say something like they took a Brahman and made it Shrutriya or something fit to be heard. So the idea that the Brahman is not actually the physical sound, but the idea of a poem. Anyway, the point is the accent shift is one of the ways of creating this derivative. So we're used to words making derivatives, maybe most commonly with like a ya extension. So Brahmanya, Brahman-like, or worthy of a Brahman, right? Take your ya, add it to the ya, to the word. Now you have a derivative. But there was evidently another way, and that was accent shift. This is not a very this is not a productive rule in the Vedas, but sometimes it's something you have to deal with. Also, there are other things that the accent tells you. Verbs in main clauses do not have accents. So if you see an accent on a verb, it means it's a verb in a subjoined clause. Vocatives do not have accents, which means the Vedic language has the only way of determining if something is a nominative plural or a vocative plural because of the presence of the accent. So people think, oh, the Vedas are going to be so hard. Actually, the accent is just a tool that makes it easier for you.
Yeah, yeah. In some ways, looks like it gives it more precision in certain,
that's right.
in certain cases.
The other thing the accent sometimes does, I mean, it does a lot of things, but if you have a situation, I'll use this. If you have a compound XY and the accent's on the first member, usually this means it's a bahuvrihi. Hmm. Whereas if you have an accent on the second member, usually it's not a bahuvrihi. That's not always 100%.
That's very helpful.
True. But it's very helpful, right? Because if you're a Rajaputra, you are one whose son is king. You're the father of a king. But if you're Rajaputra, then you are the son of the king. Now we can tell the difference thanks to the accent. So good news. In many ways, life is easier because of the Vedas.
Mm-hmm.
In other ways, it's not so true, unfortunately, because we don't have lexicographers that predated the Vedas who can tell us what these words mean. So a lot of times we see a word, it shows up one time in the corpus, we have no idea what it means. Or we have to use our best inferences and humbly guesstimate what we think this word means.
I was going to ask about that, actually. Like, what... For students of Vedic, what's a good go-to dictionary or source? I mean, how reliable is Monet Williams when we're looking at Vedic stuff? I mean, oftentimes, in fact, when we look at entries in Monet Williams, the first ones that come up are the Vedic sources.
Monet Williams is in a good order. Unfortunately, it doesn't have good meanings.
Yeah.
Similarly, the best dictionary for the Rig Veda is Grossman's dictionary. However, Grossman's dictionary doesn't have great meanings. That is, the semantics are out of date because it's like it's a century old dictionary.
Right.
What's nice about Grossman's is when it says what it thinks the word is, it will give you every attestation of its form. So what's nice about Grossman's is you're like, I think this is the intensive participle of the root dr to break. And you can look it up in Grossman's, and Grossman's going to be right about dr to break. But let's imagine that it's some, you know, you don't have to trust the semantic, but you at least know, hey, Grossman also thinks this is a form of the intensive participle of dr to break. Yeah. So Grossman's useful in that. The most up-to-date dictionary, not just for all the Vedas, is Meyerhofer's. So Meyerhofer is, you know, he created volume one, which was the first half of the alphabet. Volume two is the second half. And then volume three is for all the stuff he forgot. So with those three volumes.
Is that in German?
It's in German.
Yeah.
Mostly. And you know, if you want to do Vedic stuff, you're going to have a good grasp of dictionary German. You don't have to be an expert at German, but you need to know dictionary German, or at least get used to using Google Translate.
There you go.
So,
I'm sure you'll get more into those nitty gritties and details about tools and resources and how to do that kind of stuff in the course. Certainly. Well, that's a good, of course, I'm sure there's many, many more interesting, differences and similarities between Vedic and classical, but I'm going to go ahead and share my screen here. Can you see that?
I see Seth Powell started sharing a screen. Oh yes. I see it now.
Okay, cool. So let's talk a little bit specifics of the course. Sanskrit 303, Vedic Sanskrit. It's going to run live July 10th through September 8th, 2023. This will be available for self-study after the fact. So if you are watching or listening to this And it's after September 8th, 2023. Everything's been recorded and you can actually take this on your own. Tell us a little bit, Kaylee, about what students can expect, who this course is for. I know, you know, some students have been asking us, hey, I don't really have that much background. Is this sort of suited for me? And I think our understanding is you really do need to have about 1 to 2 years, would you say, of training in Sanskrit to really succeed in this course. Of course, you're all welcome to join and you can jump into the deep end, but I think to succeed, would you say you really do need to have some background?
I mean, it is totally possible to start with Vedic, but not in this course. Because this course, because of brevity. You know, brevity is the soul of wit, and that's why I'm not very witty. I am long-winded. But in this case, I'm going to try and basically give students in the first four courses the down low on how to use their classical knowledge to make a go of it at Vedic. Now, will it be exhaustive? No, and it can't be, because the Vedas often do surprising things that defy individual rules. But there are lots of good tendencies where I can say, you know this about classical, in Vedas, you'll see this, and this is why. If I wanted to do a zero to Vedas course, I would have to spend 9 weeks on grammar because I'd have to teach you Sanskrit. So if we want to do if you wanted to learn Vedic and not learn classical Sanskrit, first of all, ask yourself why you would want to cut out thousands of years of beautiful literature just to get at this. I didn't have a choice. This is all they taught when I was an undergrad. Anyway, for the purposes of this course, for the sake of speed, I'm really going to use two classes to go over Vedic verbal morphology, two for nominal morphology, and accent stuff. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to start reading. And a lot of the things we read will be like, I know you guys didn't figure out what this word is and we didn't talk about it, but that's because it only shows up here. And this will teach us this little principle of Vedas, right? So the text selections are also selected in order to teach us things about Vedic grammar as we go. That's the sort of challenge of undertaking a wily corpus that knew no standardization. Right.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about what students can expect to read. Again, obviously, we're limited with time constraints.
That's right. So, what I've sprinkled in the course are Vedic narratives about the origins of the Vedas. I find those interesting. And because they shift, they change, they're diverse, I think you should find those interesting too. Seth, you should update your Chrome. It's driving me crazy. Do it after.
What? Where? Oh, this?
Yeah. No, okay. Not now. Also, we're going to look at a couple narratives that don't have to do with Vedic origins, but they're important, what we might think of as mythological narratives. The importance of those narratives are not just in and of themselves, but these narratives in particular change a great deal over the Vedic period. We're going to look at some early Vedic prose, for example, and then we're going to look at earlier versions of these same narratives in the later, much harder Rig Vedic material. So one of the early Vedic prose stories we'll read at is a relationship between Yama and Yami, the first two humans. One of them will be about Sarama, the dog of Indra. Then we're going to see older versions of those narratives, and we're going to wonder, why are they different? Is this time alone change narratives, or does the application of a story to do something change a narrative? We'll discuss and explore these things. The other reason I picked some of these things is because, for instance, one of our early Vedic prose passages, our middle Vedic prose passages in module 3 is the story of Pururavas and Urvashi. I'm going to block out some of those parts because this is a middle Vedic prose commentary on a much harder Rig Vedic poem that you won't be ready for in module 3. But what's interesting here is the story of Pururavas and Urvashi. For those of you who love the Mahabharata, you can read it again in a different version of the Mahabharata. And of course, the Vikramorvashiyam by Kalidasa is a great play as well. This is evidently this narrative becomes the crux of revisitation. Sanskrit authors were compelled to revisit these stories and tweak them and change them over time. For what reasons? Well, you can be the judge of that. So essentially, we start with Vedic prose, and we will proceed to more complicated Vedic metrical things with more archaic language that will require a little commentary. And then you'll be exposed to a number of types of hymns. We'll look at dialogue hymns, which are actually in general much easier than, for instance, these speculative and riddle hymns. Now, some of these riddle hymns that I'll show you at the very end of the course, we might not know the answers to those riddles. You know, this is, as my tea says, the unknown is where all outcomes are possible. And that's very true when it comes to studying the Vedas, because this was the oeuvre, not just of one civilization, but of civilization after civilization, of a diverse group of people that span time and space in Northwest India. And their creative genius, as well as their political acumen, is baked into these texts. And that's not just one idea. It's 1,000 ideas that change and grow. Their usage of words change and grow. I feel like I should actually, at that point, comment on the word yoga, which usually in the Rig Veda just means summertime. But there's an important point here.
I had meant to ask you about that, so I'm glad you brought it up. And maybe this will be a good place to close today.
Yeah, well, that's the nature of semantic change, right? Words change meaning over time. And that's something that we get to wrestle with, because words sometimes change meaning somewhat passively, but they often change meaning through the active intellectual achievements of those who are re-articulating old ideas in new ways, yoga being an important one of those. In essence, why does yoga mean summertime, in essence, in the Rig Veda is very simple. The root yuj means to yoke. It's hitching season. It's when when resources are scarce in the winter, Vedic peoples often lived in arrangements of communal property ownership and habitation. They shifted to a more independent, spaced out, and private property model in the summer. So yoga is the hitching season. It's when they would spread out and often engaged in games of honor, that is, sport of cattle thieving and the like. And when the clans reassembled in the winter, in Kshema, the peace season, the season of rest, they had to resolve those conflicts. It's likely from this notion that yoga as a season of trekking, of trial, becomes associated with this new intellectual project of being an ascetic who is on a trek away from the shared community, who is in a way isolated and independent, like during yoga season when a clan goes off into the high grounds, into the high country to find forage for his cattle. This idea of a person on a trek, of a yogin, it may be the seed concept for someone who's out there doing yoga. And I won't elaborate because that could just be hours and hours and courses on its own. But the important thing is this. It was someone's project to say what you're doing out there, what you're doing on your own, whether it's meditation or self-mortification or deprivation, whether it's breath control, whatever you're doing, you're on a trek, man. Just like we're on a trek. That was someone's oeuvre. That was someone's genius to liken those two things through metaphor. And that's in many ways the delight of the Veda, to see generations of people using their poetic creativity and genius to warp, change, bend, and reinvent language and their conceptual vocabulary in ways that we get to see firsthand that just look like they come ex nihilo if you start with classical. When you look at the Vedas, you can see a long history of ideas that are very exciting because of their incredible consequences in the later period.
Well, very fitting. Yesterday was the summer solstice and the official mark of summer. So it's huge season, and it's the season for Vedic Sanskrit at Yogic Studies. So couldn't be more fitting, and what a great way to end what has been just a fascinating conversation, Kaylee. I thank you for your time. We could have easily kept going for another hour, but I believe you're in the process of moving, and we've got many things going on in the background.
Lots of packing.
So good luck with your upcoming move. Maybe when we see you next, you might be in a different physical space there in the Zoom room.
I will definitely have more than one shirt available.
No worries. Yes, thank you so much. Thanks to all of our listeners and viewers on YouTube and who are listening to the podcast. Feel free to comment or ask any questions that you may have to Kaylee or about the course. But for those, if you stuck it out in this conversation for this long and you're still here, then come join us for Vedic Sanskrit this summer. It's going to be a lot of fun, and I think you'll learn a lot.
It's so my final pleasure to teach it.
Yeah. Yeah. Kaylee, you know, he really means that. He's an extremely passionate and committed teacher, if you couldn't tell already from this conversation. So we're lucky to have him, and we're looking forward to the course. So thanks again, Kaylee.
Thanks, Seth.
We'll talk soon.